Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. Today, we're investigating the resurrection appearances of Jesus after the crucifixion. To that end, we're going to return to our debate between Dr. William Lang Craig versus Bishop John Spong. The debate that took place last week was the first aspect of it. Each got to present their perspective. And today, we're going to deal with the rebuttals. I'd like to point out that in this debate, they often refer to the dates and who wrote the Gospels and the comparison between the Gospels and the writings of Paul, which came first. So I would refer you back to our archives in episodes 8 to 16, where we've discussed that. In there, what we have established is that Paul was the earliest published writings, but Matthew had written some notes, which was later written into the book of Matthew by his assistant, Isidore, using writings and notes and little tidbits that the Apostle Andrew had put together, in which all four of the Gospel writers used, and today our scholars call the Q document. Today's debate really focuses on the resurrection and did Jesus resurrect, come back to life, in a physical body or in a spiritual body? We'll listen to the rebuttals, then we'll go to the Bible Heritage Foundation, and we'll have the Bible's perspective or the biblical worldview on this subject, and then we will side-by-side use the Urantia papers and their explanation of this body that Jesus appeared in and made these many appearances. We will find out that there are different numbers between the Bible perspective and the Urantia papers in numbers of appearances by Jesus. And we'll also hear that the Urantia papers use the word morantia to refer to the body of Jesus. This word really means not material, not spiritual, but somewhere in between. And this is our soul body, that when we are resurrected, we will have a morantia body. So, this is the perspective from the Urantia pages. We're just presenting the facts here as investigators, and you, once again, are the judge. So let's have a listen first to the debate, then to the biblical perspective and the Urantia book perspective side by side on the appearances of Jesus after the resurrection. Let's have a listen.
Thank you, Dr. Spong. We now have 10 minutes for the first rebuttal by Dr. Craig.
Thank you, Bishop Spong, for those thoughtful remarks and criticisms. In this speech, I'd like to re-examine the case that I presented and see how it stands up in light of Bishop Spong's criticisms. Now, you'll recall that my argument has two steps. First step is to determine the facts to be explained, and here I listed some of the reasons that have led most scholars to agree with the facts of Jesus' empty tomb, post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. Now here, Dr. Spong suggests that these narratives should be read as myths, not literally, that it's a mistake to think of them as literal. Well, now, I believe this is really a straw man. Nobody takes every passage in the Bible literally. When the psalmist says, "Let the trees of the woods clap their hands before the Lord," nobody thinks that he's teaching botany. Rather, the key to correctly interpreting the Bible is to discern the type of literature that you're reading. Now, the Bible contains a wide variety of different literary types: prophecy, history, epistle, poetry, apocalypse, and so on. And to read these indiscriminately in all the same way is going to lead to confusion. Now, when it comes to the Gospels, Bishop Spong variously classifies these, sometimes as mythology, as he did tonight, but sometimes as midrash, sometimes as legend, sometimes as theology, and so on. The problem is that these are all distinct literary types, different from one another. But Dr. Spong, rather like that fellow in the Florida orange juice commercial, just throws everything into the blender at once and comes up with a sort of literary mash. And this isn't apt to be very helpful, I think, in our understanding of the Gospels. Let me share with you then the thinking of contemporary scholarship concerning the literary type of the Gospels. Contemporary scholars have come to realize that the Gospel's literary type is not mythology or midrash, but rather it is ancient biography, like Plutarch's famous Lives of Illustrious Greeks and Romans. According to Craig Keener in his recent commentary on the Gospel of John, and I quote, "The Gospels present themselves as true accounts of Jesus' ministry. All four Gospels fit the genre of ancient biography, the life of a prominent person. Jewish Christian readers would have been most familiar with literary works concerning primary characters in terms of Hellenistic lives or ancient biographies." He concludes, "Arguments concerning the biographical character of the Gospels have thus come full circle. The Gospels, long viewed as biographies until the 20th century, now again are widely viewed as biographies." Moreover, Keener notes, ancient biographies were a form of historical writing. He says biographies were essentially historical works. Thus, the Gospels would have an essentially historical function. So a correct analysis of the Gospels' literary type shows that they are meant to be an account of what actually happened. Moreover, Keener notes two factors undergirding the reliability of these biographies. First, how close the Gospel sources are to the events that they narrate, and secondly, the Gospels' care in handing down the information in their sources. He concludes on the basis of these two factors that the Gospel should be placed among the most reliable of ancient biographies. So the bottom line then is that the Gospels are not mythology or midrash, rather they are ancient biography and pretty reliable ones at that. Now, Bishop Spong also says that should we think of the resurrection of Jesus as literal? Well, I think that question has been answered decisively by N.T. Wright in his recent book, The Resurrection of the Son of God. Wright does a study of how the word resurrection is used in ancient history, in paganism, in Judaism, in Christianity. And he concludes that there is no evidence for Jews of our period using the word resurrection to denote something essentially non-concrete. Raymond Brown agrees. He says it is not accurate to claim that the New Testament references to the resurrection of Jesus are ambiguous as to whether they meant bodily resurrection. There was no other kind of resurrection. So when early Christians said he is risen from the dead, they meant it literally and bodily. And thus you have Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 arguing with the Corinthians over the question, with what kind of body do they come? The sermons in the book of Acts portray the resurrection as a physical event witnessed by various people. And of course, the empty tomb itself is testimony that this was taken to be a literal event, leaving an empty tomb in its wake. But Bishop Spong has a third objection. He says, what about all the inconsistencies in the narratives? Well, as I said in my first speech, no historian just throws out a source because it has inconsistencies. Indeed, the very task of the critical historian is to sift his sources to distinguish the historical from the unhistorical. And so looking for inconsistencies is just too blunt a tool to be of much value in analyzing one's sources. It's like trying to do brain surgery with a machete. Moreover, the inconsistencies that Bishop Spong is talking about aren't within a single source. They're between independent sources. But obviously, it doesn't follow from an inconsistency between independent sources that both of the sources are wrong. At worst, it only follows that one is wrong if they cannot be harmonized. Now, I think that most of the inconsistencies he mentioned can be harmonized. There are all answers to all of these, but I don't have time in this speech, obviously, to deal with them. Let me simply point out that the Gospel accounts are unanimous and harmonious in their historical core, which is what I'm arguing for tonight. The discrepancies occur in the secondary details. All four Gospels agree on the following facts: that Jesus of Nazareth was crucified in Jerusalem by Roman authority at the time of the Passover feast, having been arrested and convicted on charges of blasphemy by the Jewish Sanhedrin, and then slandered before the Roman governor Pilate on charges of treason. He died within a few hours and was buried Friday afternoon by Joseph of Arimathea in a tomb, which was then sealed with a stone. Certain women followers of Jesus, including Mary Magdalene, having observed his interment, visited his tomb early on Sunday morning, only to find it empty. Thereafter, Jesus appeared alive from the dead to the disciples, including Peter, who then became proclaimers of the message of his resurrection. Now, all four Gospels agree on those facts. Many more details could be added if you include, in addition to that, facts which are attested by three out of the four. The historian Michael Grant concludes, true, the discovery of the empty tomb is narrated differently by the different Gospels. But if we apply the same sort of criteria that we would apply to any other ancient literary sources, then the evidence is firm and plausible enough to necessitate the conclusion that the tomb was indeed found empty. So I think we have good grounds for believing that the tomb was empty. What about the appearances? Well, here Bishop Spong asked, are they really physical? Isn't that a feature only of the later Gospels? Well, the case I presented doesn't depend on the nature of the appearances. It leaves it open whether they were visionary or physical. But let me say briefly why I do think they were physical. The claim that they only were physical in later Gospels assumes that these Gospels were written much later. But I think we have every reason to think that Acts was written prior to AD 62, and Luke's Gospel, therefore, sometime in the late AD 50s. That places it just as early as Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. Secondly, there's no evidence whatsoever that physical appearances only came later. On the contrary, we have multiple independent attestation of physical appearances. Indeed, our sources are unanimous on this. Thirdly, if originally all the disciples saw were visions of Jesus, then it wouldn't have led to belief in his resurrection. At most, it would have led to belief in his exaltation to heaven, but not to his being raised from the dead. So I think we've got good grounds for affirming the appearances. Dr. Spong agrees with me that something big and powerful happened to bring about the origin of the disciples' belief. And he says we must affirm the reality of the resurrection, and we must affirm that it be available in every generation. But where my disagreement is, I think, is that Bishop Spong wants to retain the language of Christian theology while evacuating it of any literal significance. On Bishop Spong's view, Jesus wasn't literally raised from the dead. His corpse was thrown into a shallow dirt grave where it rotted away. Jesus is literally dead. So the words about Jesus being raised in the meaning of God and the resurrection being available to every generation really are in the end empty. It's just flowery phrases. It is the language of Christian theology, but without the literal content. And so my concern is that the power and life of the resurrection cannot be available to every generation unless this is a real event that actually happened rather than just mythology or a fairy tale. And therefore, I think it's critical that we affirm the historicity of the resurrection as a basis for our affirmation of its meaning.
Thank you, Dr. Craig. And now Bishop Spong for the rebuttal.
I have great admiration for a man who can quote Gerd Ludemann and Tom Wright in the same presentation. They represent sort of the extremes in biblical scholarship. Dr. Craig has used a trick. That's an incorrect word. He's used, what shall I say? He's done the same thing that politicians do. He says, everybody thinks of it my way. Most scholars, he said a number of times, do this. Most scholars do that. Well, he and I must read a totally different group of scholars. I'm a member of the Jesus Seminar. We have 250 PhD Bible scholars, Catholic and Protestant, and they would not agree at all with either the timing that Dr. Craig mentioned or with some of his historicity of such things as the tomb, the empty tomb. When you read biblical material, you're not always reading primary sources. We know for a fact that Matthew copied Mark into his gospel. Matthew copies about 90% of Mark into his gospel. We know that Luke also had Mark in front of him when he wrote. So Luke copies about half of Mark into his gospel. So when Matthew, Mark, and Luke agree, It's no mystery. They have the same source. Mark is the primary source for all of them. Let me suggest that our dating system would be quite different. Paul, in my dating scheme, would write between 50 and 64. I assume that you would agree probably with that. But when we get past that, I would date Mark after 70. I would date Matthew in the mid-80s. I would date Luke the late 80s, maybe even the early 90s. And I've never seen anybody that suggested that Acts was as early as Dr. Craig has suggested. Indeed, if you read people like Burton Mack, you'll find that he dates Acts way in the second century. There's a great deal of debate about that. But it's interesting to me that the people who want to make sure that literal biblical content is believed always opt for the earlier and earlier dating processes, which I don't believe can be substantiated. The fact is that the Gospels are written sometime between 40 and 70 years after the earthly life of Jesus came to an end, and it was written in a language that Jesus didn't speak. So before you and I read our Bibles, the story of Jesus has lived in oral transmission for 40 to 70 years and has gone through one translation. All I want us to do is to keep open our minds to the possibility that the story might have grown in that transmission. Not the essential experience, but the way it is described. Please recognize there is a difference between an experience which is real and eternal and the way anybody explains that experience at any given moment in time. The explanation always warps it in time, always binds it in time. Let me also suggest that the idea that the Gospels are biography is an idea that I know of no one in the New Testament world that I associate with would agree. I think of the Gospels, at least the Synoptics, I can't make a case for John, but the Synoptics, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, I would say that the underlying principle creating those is liturgy, not biography, liturgy. He even suggested that everybody agrees that the crucifixion took place during the time of the Passover. I'm not sure everybody agrees with that at all. One of the earliest ways in which the Christ was interpreted was by Paul, who said, Christ is our new Passover. And you need to understand the Jewish Passover to understand what that claim was. It was an astonishing claim. In the Passover story, the angel of death passed over Jewish homes where the blood of the Paschal Lamb had been placed on the doorpost. So the blood of the Paschal Lamb was thought to have the power to dispel death. Paul says, Jesus is our new Passover. I think what lies behind that is that people were trying to process the Jesus experience. He died on the cross. They needed to make sense out of that. And so they likened it to the death of the Paschal Lamb. The cross became the doorpost of the world. The blood of the Paschal Lamb was shed on the cross. That blood has the power to overcome death. Those of us who come to God through that Paschal Lamb's self-offering can find eternal life. That's a powerful sermon that Paul was preaching. And I think that's probably what led them to see or to begin to place the crucifixion at the time of the Passover. A scholar at Birmingham University, where Dr. Craig got his doctorate, is named Michael Donald Goulder. Fascinating man, because he became an atheist late in his life, but he was a profound New Testament scholar. But Michael Goulder suggested that the primary thing that organizes the New Testament is the liturgical life of the synagogue, because the stories of Jesus were remembered and recalled in the synagogue. That's where they lived. The Christian movement didn't break away from the synagogue officially until 88 of this common era. So the Jesus narrative was lived in the synagogue. And as it was lived in the synagogue, it was constantly interpreted against synagogue worship. Have you ever wondered why Mark is the shortest gospel of the three? I think it's because Mark gives you Jesus stories that go from Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year, to Passover, the first celebration of the Jewish year in the month of Nisan. And John the Baptist, who opens Mark's gospel, is very much a Rosh Hashanah figure. What happened at Rosh Hashanah? They blew the trumpet. They gathered the people. They said, prepare for the kingdom of God to come, which is the essential John the Baptist message. And then you drive that gospel all the way through. The Jews had a day called the Festival of Dedication. It came in the month of Kislev, our month of December. We tend to call it Hanukkah. But in the Festival of Dedication, they celebrated the light of God being restored to the temple, the true worship of God being restored. It comes out of the Maccabean period of Jewish history. It's interesting to me that exactly at that point in Mark's gospel, he tells the story of the transfiguration of Jesus, the light of God coming down upon Jesus, who is the new temple, the new meeting place between God and human life. And the idea that Jesus is the new temple gets picked up in the later Gospels when Jesus is quoted as saying, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will build it up. And they didn't understand, says the Gospel writer, because he was referring to the temple of his own body. The only way that I believe that they could have seen Jesus as the new temple was that they lived in a world where the temple had been destroyed, which happened in the year 70 AD in the Great Roman War. So I see Jesus being interpreted liturgically against the background of the Jewish worship cycle, and that's the organizing principle. The reason Matthew and Luke had to expand Mark was that they wanted to have Christian readings for all of the Sabbaths of the year. And Mark only provided about 6.5 months. So Matthew and Luke both stretched Mark. Matthew stretched it in a very Jewish direction. Luke stretched it in a much more Gentile direction. I think if we can begin to develop liturgical eyes, to begin to read our narratives, we will begin to see so much more. One of the reasons that I don't think we've been able as Christians to look at the Bible as that which grew, look at the Gospels as that which grew out of the synagogue worship tradition, is that we have been frankly anti-Semitic throughout our history. When I was a Sunday school boy, going to my evangelical Sunday school in Charlotte, North Carolina, I never met a good Jew in my Sunday school material. They were all evil people. They were sinister. They were out to get Jesus, or they were out to get Paul. Nobody ever told me that Jesus was a Jew. That sort of escaped notice. Oh, I knew that Judas Iscariot was a Jew. I knew that the Pharisees and the Sadducees were Jews, and the chief priests were Jews. The scribes, they were Jews. But nobody ever told me that Jesus was a Jew, and that Paul was a Jew, and that Mary and Joseph were Jews, and Mary Magdalene was a Jew, and all of the disciples were Jews, because they were good people. It was given to me as good Christians against bad Jews. Well, I think we've got to begin to open our eyes and to recognize that this Jewish Jesus was interpreted first within a Jewish frame of reference. And then when we left that frame of reference, we lost a lot of our understanding. One final note before I finish. You've heard many a time, I'm sure, Jesus died for my sins. It's a mantra among Christians. You ever wonder where it comes from? The Jews had a day called Yom Kippur, where they killed a lamb who was perfect mentally, morally, and physically. And then they took the blood of this lamb who stood between them and God, because they weren't aware, they weren't capable of standing in that place close to God. And they sprinkled the blood of this lamb on the people so that they were washed in the blood of the lamb, cleansed from their sins and restored to God. That was a Jewish worship tradition, and it has deep echoes in the Christian tradition, and I think we miss them because we cannot read the Bible with Jewish eyes.
Thank you very much, Bishop Spong. We have now concluded the first part of this debate.
We'd like to thank Dr. Lang and Bishop Spong for this debate. We will continue with the final arguments next week. And today, here, we now pick up from the Bible Heritage Foundation the story of Jesus with the New Testament's perspective on the resurrection and the appearances of Jesus. The Bible references for this today is Matthew 28, verses 1 to 8, Mark 16, verses 1 to 8, Luke 24, verses 1 to 8, and John 20, verses 1 to 10. Here, according to the New Testament, the angels announce the resurrection of Jesus. The location for this is in Joseph's garden, and it's early Easter Sunday morning. Let's have a listen to this.
The Story of Jesus, Part 8, Resurrection of Jesus. Chapter 145, Angels Announce the Resurrection. But when the Sabbath was passed on the first day of the week, early in the morning, they came to anoint the body of Jesus. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary had prepared spices and were coming to prepare the body of Jesus for final burial. Before they approached the tomb, there was a great earthquake, and an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. The angel's appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The Roman guards were paralyzed with fear and became like dead men. When Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to the place where Jesus had been buried, the stone was already rolled away, and the Roman guard had fled. And when they entered the tomb, the Lord's body was not there. Mary Magdalene ran to find Simon Peter and the other disciple that loved Jesus. And when she found them, she said, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." While Mary was gone to get Peter and John, two angels, appearing as young men in dazzling apparel, appeared to those that were still at the tomb. They were very frightened and bowed down their faces to the earth. The angel said to the women, "Don't be afraid. We know that you're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who has been crucified. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? He is not here. He is risen, just like he said he would. Don't you remember what he told you when he was in Galilee, telling you that the Son of Man was going to be delivered up to the hands of sinful men and be crucified and rise again on the third day?" They remembered the words of Jesus, "Come, look, the place where he laid. See, the place where the Lord lay. Now go quickly and tell his disciples and Peter, he is risen from the dead, and he is going before you into Galilee. You will see him there." And they left quickly and fled from the tomb with fear and great joy. And they ran to bring word to the disciples. They did not speak to anyone they met on the way about what had happened because they were trembling and astonished. Peter and John ran to the tomb. John outran Peter and arrived first. He stooped down and looked at the linen cloth that was lying in place. Peter ran right into the tomb and saw the linen cloth lying by themselves, and the napkin that had been upon his head was rolled up in a place by itself. Then the disciples entered the tomb and saw and believed that Jesus had risen from the dead. The disciples went home wondering about all that had come to pass. Chapter 146, Appearances of the Risen Christ. Now after Peter and John had gone home to ponder what they had seen, Mary Magdalene returned to the garden where Jesus had been buried. Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping. As she wept, she stooped down to look into the tomb. She saw two angels in white, one at the head and the other at the foot of where Jesus had lain. Jesus then came to Mary and said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to him, not recognizing him because of her sorrow and thinking he was the gardener, "They have taken my Lord away, and I do not know where they have laid him." And she turned around and saw Jesus plainly and recognized him and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which is to say, "Teacher." Jesus said to her, "Do not touch me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. I am going to see the brethren and to say to them, I ascend to my Father and your Father and my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went and told some of the disciples, "I have seen the Lord, he is alive." But they disbelieved her. Then Jesus met them, Mary Magdalene and others who had come to anoint Jesus' body, saying, "Rejoice." And they came and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Fear not. Go tell my brethren that I am going to Galilee and that I will see them there." The ones that had seen Jesus were Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James and the other women that were with them. They told the disciples, but they did not believe. They thought it was just idle talk. Chapter 147, Guards Report to the Jewish Rulers. Now while the group of women were going to tell the disciples, some of the soldiers that had been guarding the tomb went to the chief priests and told them all the things that had happened. And when they were assembled and had considered the matter, they gave money to the soldiers and told them to report that the disciples of Jesus had stolen the body of Jesus while they slept. If news of this gets to the governor's ear, we will persuade him to overlook the offense. The soldiers took the money and did what they were told. And the report spread among the Jews and is still reported to this day.
Paper 190, Marantia Appearances of Jesus. The resurrected Jesus now prepares to spend a short period on Urantia for the purpose of experiencing the ascending Marantia career of a mortal of the realms. Although this time of the Marantia life is to be spent on the world of his mortal incarnation, it will, however, be in all respects the counterpart of the experience of Satania mortals who pass through the progressive Marantia life of the seven mansion worlds of Jerusalem. All this power which is inherent in Jesus, the endowment of life, and which enabled him to rise from the dead, is the very gift of eternal life which he bestows upon kingdom believers, and which even now makes certain their resurrection from the bonds of natural death. The mortals of the realms will arise in the morning of the resurrection with the same type of transition or Marantia body that Jesus had when he arose from the tomb on this Sunday morning. These bodies do not have circulating blood, and such beings do not partake of ordinary material food. Nevertheless, these Marantia forms are real. When the various believers saw Jesus after his resurrection, they really saw him. They were not the self-deceived victims of visions or hallucinations. Abiding faith in the resurrection of Jesus was the cardinal feature of the faith of all branches of the early gospel teaching. In Jerusalem, Alexandria, Antioch, and Philadelphia, all the gospel teachers united in this implicit faith in the Master's resurrection. In viewing the prominent part which Mary Magdalene took in proclaiming the Master's resurrection, it should be recorded that Mary was the chief spokesman for the women's corps, as was Peter for the apostles. Mary was not the chief of the women workers, but she was their chief teacher and public spokesman. Mary had become a woman of great circumspection, so that her boldness in speaking to a man whom she considered to be the caretaker of Joseph's garden only indicates how horrified she was to find the tomb empty. It was the depth and agony of her love, the fullness of her devotion, that caused her to forget, for a moment, the conventional restraints of a Jewish woman's approach to a strange man. 1. Heralds of the Resurrection. The apostles did not want Jesus to leave them. Therefore had they slighted all his statements about dying, along with his promises to rise again. They were not expecting the resurrection as it came, and they refused to believe until they were confronted with the compulsion of unimpeachable evidence and the absolute proof of their own experiences. When the apostles refused to believe the report of the five women who represented that they had seen Jesus and talked with him, Mary Magdalene returned to the tomb, and the others went back to Joseph's house, where they related their experiences to his daughter and the other women. And the women believed their report. Shortly after 6 o'clock, the daughter of Joseph of Arimathea and the four women who had seen Jesus went over to the home of Nicodemus, where they related all these happenings to Joseph, Nicodemus, David Zebedee, and the other men there assembled. Nicodemus and the others doubted their story, doubted that Jesus had risen from the dead. They conjectured that the Jews had removed the body. Joseph and David were disposed to believe the report, so much so that they hurried out to inspect the tomb, and they found everything just as the women had described. And they were the last to so view the sepulchre, for the high priest sent the captain of the temple guards to the tomb at 7:30 to remove the grave cloths. The captain wrapped them all up in the linen sheet and threw them over a nearby cliff. From the tomb, David and Joseph went immediately to the home of Elijah Mark, where they held a conference with the 10 apostles in the upper chamber. Only John Zebedee was disposed to believe, even faintly, that Jesus had risen from the dead. Peter had believed at first, but, when he failed to find the Master, fell into grave doubting. They were all disposed to believe that the Jews had removed the body. David would not argue with them, but when he left, he said, "You are the apostles, and you ought to understand these things. I will not contend with you, Nevertheless, I now go back to the home of Nicodemus, where I have appointed with the messengers to assemble this morning. And when they have gathered together, I will send them forth on their last mission, as heralds of the Master's resurrection. I heard the Master say that, after he should die, he would rise on the third day, and I believe him. And thus speaking to the dejected and forlorn ambassadors of the kingdom, this self-appointed chief of communication and intelligence took leave of the apostles. On his way from the upper chamber, he dropped the bag of Judas, containing all the apostolic funds, in the lap of Matthew Levi. It was about 9:30 when the last of David's 26 messengers arrived at the home of Nicodemus. David promptly assembled them in the spacious courtyard and addressed them. Men and brethren, all this time you have served me in accordance with your oath to me and to one another, and I call you to witness that I have never yet sent out false information at your hands. I am about to send you on your last mission as volunteer messengers of the kingdom, and in so doing I release you from your oaths and thereby disband the messenger corps. Men, I declare to you that we have finished our work. No more does the Master have need of mortal messengers. He has risen from the dead. He told us before they arrested him that he would die and rise again on the third day. I have seen the tomb. It is empty. I have talked with Mary Magdalene and four other women who have talked with Jesus. I now disband you, bid you farewell, and send you on your respective assignments, and the message which you shall bear to the believers is, Jesus has risen from the dead. The tomb is empty. The majority of those present endeavored to persuade David not to do this, but they could not influence him. They then sought to dissuade the messengers, but they would not heed the words of doubt. And so, shortly before 10:00 this Sunday morning, these 26 runners went forth as the first heralds of the mighty truth fact of the resurrected Jesus. And they started out on this mission, as they had on so many others, in fulfillment of their oath to David Zebedee and to one another. These men had great confidence in David. They departed on this assignment without even tarrying to talk with those who had seen Jesus. They took David at his word. The majority of them believed what David had told them, and even those who somewhat doubted carried the message just as certainly and just as swiftly. The apostles, the spiritual core of the kingdom, are this day assembled in the upper chamber, where they manifest fear and express doubts. While these laymen, representing the first attempt at the socialization of the Master's gospel of the brotherhood of man, under the orders of their fearless and efficient leader, go forth to proclaim the risen Savior of a world and a universe. And they engage in this eventful service ere his chosen representatives are willing to believe his word or to accept the evidence of eyewitnesses. These 26 were dispatched to the home of Lazarus in Bethany and to all of the believer centers, from Beersheba in the south to Damascus and Sidon in the north, and from Philadelphia in the east to Alexandria in the west. When David had taken leave of his brethren, he went over to the home of Joseph for his mother, and they then went out to Bethany to join the waiting family of Jesus. David abode there in Bethany with Martha and Mary until after they had disposed of their earthly possessions, and he accompanied them on their journey to join their brother Lazarus at Philadelphia. In about 1 week from this time, John Zebedee took Mary, the mother of Jesus, to his home in Bethsaida. James, Jesus' eldest brother, remained with his family in Jerusalem. Ruth remained at Bethany with Lazarus' sisters. The rest of Jesus' family returned to Galilee. David Zebedee left Bethany with Martha and Mary for Philadelphia early in June, the day after his marriage to Ruth, Jesus' youngest sister.
Chapters 148, Third and Fourth Appearances of Jesus. After this, Jesus appeared to two men as they walked on their way to the village of Emmaus, a village about 3/4 of a mile from Jerusalem. And as the two men were talking to each other, Jesus walked up to them. Jesus hid who he was. And Jesus said to them, "What are you talking about as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. One of the men, whose name was Cleopas, answered and said to him, "Are you the only one in Jerusalem that does not know what has happened in the past couple of days?" Jesus said, "What things?" And they answered, "The things concerning Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet mighty in word and deed before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. We had hoped that he was the one that was going to redeem Israel. And besides this, it is now the third day since these things came to pass, and certain women of our company amazed us, having gone to the tomb and finding it empty. They also saw a vision of angels, who said that Jesus was alive. And certain of those that were with us went to the tomb and found it just like the women said, but they didn't see any angels. And then Jesus said to them, O foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all the prophets have spoken. Wasn't it written that the Christ should suffer all these things and enter into his glory? And then beginning from Moses and including all the prophets, he interpreted to them all the scriptures and all the things concerning himself. And as they came near their village, Jesus began to walk further. And they stopped him and said, Stay with us, for it is getting dark and the day is almost over. And Jesus went with them and stayed with them. And when it came time for the meal, he sat down to eat with them and took bread and blessed it and gave it to them. And at that moment their eyes were opened, and they saw it was Jesus. And Jesus instantly vanished from their sight. And they said to one another, Didn't our hearts burn within us while he spoke to us in the way and opened the scriptures to us? And they got up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 together and those that were with them, about 120. And they told the disciples and the others how Jesus had made himself known to them, but they did not believe.
2. Jesus' appearance at Bethany. From the time of the Maranatha resurrection until the hour of his Spirit ascension on high, Jesus made 19 separate appearances in visible form to his believers on earth. He did not appear to his enemies, nor to those who could not make spiritual use of his manifestation in visible form. His first appearance was to the 5 women at the tomb, his second to Mary Magdalene, also at the tomb. The third appearance occurred about noon of this Sunday at Bethany. Shortly after noontide, Jesus' oldest brother, James, was standing in the garden of Lazarus before the empty tomb of the resurrected brother of Martha and Mary, turning over in his mind the news brought to them about 1 hour previously by the messenger of David. James had always inclined to believe in his eldest brother's mission on earth, but he had long since lost contact with Jesus' work and had drifted into grave doubting regarding the later claims of the apostles that Jesus was the Messiah. The whole family was startled and well-nigh confounded by the news brought by the messenger. Even as James stood before Lazarus' empty tomb, Mary Magdalene arrived on the scene and was excitedly relating to the family her experiences of the early morning hours at the tomb of Joseph. Before she had finished, David Zebedee and his mother arrived. Ruth, of course, believed the report, and so did Jude after he had talked with David and Salome. In the meantime, as they looked for James and before they found him, while he stood there in the garden near the tomb, he became aware of a nearby presence as if someone had touched him on the shoulder, and when he turned to look, he beheld the gradual appearance of a strange form by his side. He was too much amazed to speak and too frightened to flee. And then the strange form spoke, saying, James, I come to call you to the service of the kingdom. Join earnest hands with your brethren and follow after me. When James heard his name spoken, he knew that it was his eldest brother, Jesus, who had addressed him. They all had more or less difficulty in recognizing the Maranatha form of the Master, but few of them had any trouble recognizing his voice or otherwise identifying his charming personality when he once began to communicate with them. When James perceived that Jesus was addressing him, he started to fall to his knees, exclaiming, My father and my brother. But Jesus bade him stand while he spoke with him. And they walked through the garden and talked for almost 3 minutes, talked over experiences of former days and forecast the events of the near future. As they neared the house, Jesus said, Farewell, James, until I greet you all together. James rushed into the house, even while they looked for him at Bethpage, exclaiming, I have just seen Jesus and talked with him, visited with him. He is not dead. He has risen. He vanished before me, saying, Farewell until I greet you all together. He had scarcely finished speaking when Jude returned, and he retold the experience of meeting Jesus in the garden for the benefit of Jude. And they all began to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. James now announced that he would not return to Galilee, and David exclaimed, He is seen not only by excited women, even strong-hearted men have begun to see him. I expect to see him myself. and David did not long wait, for the fourth appearance of Jesus to mortal recognition occurred shortly before 2 o'clock in this very home of Martha and Mary, when he appeared visibly before his earthly family and their friends, 20 in all. The Master appeared in the open back door, saying, "Peace be upon you. Greetings to those once near me in the flesh, and fellowship for my brothers and sisters in the kingdom of heaven." How could you doubt? Why have you lingered so long before choosing to follow the light of truth with a whole heart? Come, therefore, all of you, into the fellowship of the Spirit of truth in the Father's kingdom. As they began to recover from the first shock of their amazement, and to move toward him as if to embrace him, he vanished from their sight. They all wanted to rush off to the city to tell the doubting apostles about what had happened, but James restrained them. Mary Magdalene only was permitted to return to Joseph's house. James forbade their publishing abroad the fact of this Maroncha visit because of certain things which Jesus had said to him as they conversed in the garden. But James never revealed more of his visit with the risen Master on this day at the Lazarus home in Bethany. Three, at the home of Joseph. The fifth Maroncha manifestation of Jesus to the recognition of mortal eyes occurred in the presence of some 25 women believers assembled at the home of Joseph of Arimathea at about 4:15 on this same Sunday afternoon. Mary Magdalene had returned to Joseph's house just a few minutes before this appearance. James, Jesus' brother, had requested that nothing be said to the apostles concerning the Master's appearance at Bethany. He had not asked Mary to refrain from reporting the occurrence to her sister believers. Accordingly, after Mary had pledged all the women to secrecy, she proceeded to relate what had so recently happened while she was with Jesus' family at Bethany. And she was in the very midst of this thrilling recital when a sudden and solemn hush fell over them. They beheld in their very midst the fully visible form of the risen Jesus. He greeted them, saying, "Peace be upon you. In the fellowship of the kingdom there shall be neither Jew nor Gentile, rich nor poor, free nor bond, man nor woman. You also are called to publish the good news of the liberty of mankind through the gospel of sonship with God in the kingdom of heaven. Go to all the world proclaiming this gospel and confirming believers in the faith thereof. And while you do this, forget not to minister to the sick and strengthen those who are faint-hearted and fear-ridden. And I will be with you always, even to the ends of the earth." And when he had thus spoken, he vanished from their sight, while the women fell on their faces and worshipped in silence. Of the 5 Maroncha appearances of Jesus occurring up to this time, Mary Magdalene had witnessed 4. As a result of sending out the messengers during the mid-forenoon, and from the unconscious leakage of intimations concerning this appearance of Jesus at Joseph's house, word began to come to the rulers of the Jews during the early evening that it was being reported about the city that Jesus had risen, and that many persons were claiming to have seen him. The Sanhedrists were thoroughly aroused by these rumors. After a hasty consultation with Annas, Caiaphas called a meeting of the Sanhedrin to convene at 8 o'clock that evening. It was at this meeting that action was taken to throw out of the synagogues any person who made mention of Jesus' resurrection. It was even suggested that anyone claiming to have seen him should be put to death. This proposal, however, did not come to a vote, since the meeting broke up in confusion bordering on actual panic. They had dared to think they were through with Jesus. They were about to discover that their real trouble with the man of Nazareth had just begun. 4. Appearance to the Greeks. About 4:30, at the home of one Flavius, the Master made his 6th Maroncha appearance to some 40 Greek believers there assembled. While they were engaged in discussing the reports of the Master's resurrection, he manifested himself in their midst, notwithstanding that the doors were securely fastened, and speaking to them said, "Peace be upon you. While the Son of Man appeared on earth among the Jews, he came to minister to all men. In the kingdom of my Father, there shall be neither Jew nor Gentile. You will all be brethren, the sons of God. Go you, therefore, to all the world, proclaiming this gospel of salvation as you have received it from the ambassadors of the kingdom, and I will fellowship you in the brotherhood of the Father's sons of faith and truth. And when he had thus charged them, he took leave, and they saw him no more. They remained within the house all evening. They were too much overcome with awe and fear to venture forth. Neither did any of these Greeks sleep that night. They stayed awake discussing these things, and hoping that the Master might again visit them. Among this group were many of the Greeks who were at Gethsemane when the soldiers arrested Jesus and Judas betrayed him with a kiss. Rumors of Jesus' resurrection and reports concerning the many appearances to his followers are spreading rapidly, and the whole city is being wrought up to a high pitch of excitement. Already the Master has appeared to his family, to the women, and to the Greeks, and presently he manifests himself in the midst of the apostles. The Sanhedrin is soon to begin the consideration of these new problems, which have been so suddenly thrust upon the Jewish rulers. Jesus thinks much about his apostles, but desires that they be left alone for a few more hours of solemn reflection and thoughtful consideration before he visits them. 5. The Walk with Two Brothers. At Emmaus, about 7 miles west of Jerusalem, there lived two brothers, shepherds, who had spent the Passover week in Jerusalem attending upon the sacrifices, ceremonials, and feasts. Cleopas, the elder, was a partial believer in Jesus. At least he had been cast out of the synagogue. His brother Jacob was not a believer, although he was much intrigued by what he had heard about the Master's teachings and works. On this Sunday afternoon, about 3 miles out of Jerusalem, and a few minutes before 5 o'clock, as these brothers trudged along the road to Emmaus, they talked in great earnestness about Jesus, his teachings, work, and more especially concerning the rumors that his tomb was empty, and that certain of the women had talked with him. Cleopas was half a mind to believe these reports, but Jacob was insistent that the whole affair was probably a fraud. While they thus argued and debated as they made their way toward home, the Maranatha manifestation of Jesus, his seventh appearance, came alongside them as they journeyed on. Cleopas had often heard Jesus teach and had eaten with him at the homes of Jerusalem believers on several occasions, but he did not recognize the Master even when he spoke freely with them. After walking a short way with them, Jesus said, "What were the words you exchanged so earnestly as I came upon you?" And when Jesus had spoken, they stood still and viewed him with sad surprise. Said Cleopas, "Can it be that you sojourn in Jerusalem and know not the things which have recently happened?" Then asked the Master, "What things?" Cleopas replied, "If you do not know about these matters, you are the only one in Jerusalem who has not heard these rumors concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in word and in deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to the Romans and demanded that they crucify him. Now many of us had hoped that it was he who would deliver Israel from the yoke of the Gentiles, but that is not all. It is now the third day since he was crucified, and certain women have this day amazed us by declaring that very early this morning they went to his tomb and found it empty. And these same women insist that they talked with this man. They maintain that he has risen from the dead. And when the women reported this to the men, two of his apostles ran to the tomb and likewise found it empty." And here Jacob interrupted his brother to say, "But they did not see Jesus." As they walked along, Jesus said to them, "How slow you are to comprehend the truth. When you tell me that it is about the teachings and work of this man that you have your discussions, then may I enlighten you, since I am more than familiar with these teachings. Do you not remember that this Jesus always taught that his kingdom was not of this world, and that all men, being the sons of God, should find liberty and freedom in the spiritual joy of the fellowship of the brotherhood of loving service in this new kingdom of the truth of the Heavenly Father's love? Do you not recall how the Son of Man proclaimed the salvation of God for all men, ministering to the sick and afflicted, and setting free those who were bound by fear and enslaved by evil? Do you not know that this man of Nazareth told his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, be delivered up to his enemies, who would put him to death, and that he would arise on the third day? Have you not been told all this? And have you never read in the Scriptures concerning this day of salvation for Jew and Gentile, where it says that in him shall all the families of the earth be blessed, that he will hear the cry of the needy and save the souls of the poor who seek him, that all nations shall call him blessed. That such a deliverer shall be as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. That he will feed the flock like a true shepherd, gathering the lambs in his arms and tenderly carrying them in his bosom. That he will open the eyes of the spiritually blind and bring the prisoners of despair out into full liberty and light. That all who sit in darkness shall see the great light of eternal salvation. That he will bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to the captives of sin, and open up the prison to those who are enslaved by fear and bound by evil. That he will comfort those who mourn and bestow upon them the joy of salvation in the place of sorrow and heaviness. That he shall be the desire of all nations and the everlasting joy of those who seek righteousness. That this Son of Truth and Righteousness shall rise upon the world with healing light and saving power. Even that he will save his people from their sins. That he will really seek and save those who are lost. That he will not destroy the weak, but minister salvation to all who hunger and thirst for righteousness. That those who believe in him shall have eternal life. That he will pour out his Spirit upon all flesh, and that this Spirit of Truth shall be in each believer a well of water, springing up into everlasting life. Did you not understand how great was the gospel of the kingdom which this man delivered to you? Do you not perceive how great a salvation has come upon you? By this time they had come near to the village where these brothers dwelt. Not a word had these two men spoken since Jesus began to teach them as they walked along the way. Soon they drew up in front of their humble dwelling place, and Jesus was about to take leave of them, going on down the road, but they constrained him to come in and abide with them. They insisted that it was near nightfall, and that he tarry with them. Finally Jesus consented, and very soon after they went into the house, they sat down to eat. They gave him the bread to bless, and as he began to break and hand to them, their eyes were opened, and Cleopas recognized that their guest was the Master himself. And when he said, "It is the Master," the Maroncha Jesus vanished from their sight. And then they said the one to the other, "No wonder our hearts burned within us as he spoke to us while we walked along the road, and while he opened up to our understanding the teachings of the Scriptures." They would not stop to eat. They had seen the Maroncha Master, and they rushed from the house, hastening back to Jerusalem to spread the good news of the risen Savior. About 9 o'clock that evening, and just before the Master appeared to the 10, these two excited brothers broke in upon the apostles in the upper chamber, declaring that they had seen Jesus and talked with him. And they told all that Jesus had said to them, and how they had not discerned who he was until the time of the breaking of the bread.
Chapter 149, Fifth Appearance of Jesus. While the men from Emmaus were still speaking, Jesus was manifest to the disciples as they sat together. The disciples were in fear of the Jews and had locked the doors in the place where they were staying. So when they saw Jesus, they became terrified and afraid, thinking he was a spirit. Jesus scolded them for their unbelief and hardness of heart for not believing the eyewitnesses that had already reported his resurrection. "Why are you troubled? And why do you have questions come up in your mind?" said Jesus. "See my hands and my feet? It is me. Handle me for yourself, and convince yourself that I am not a spirit. Does a spirit have flesh and bones? And you see that I have." And Jesus showed them the wounds on his hands and his feet and his side. While they were still in shock and suffering from a combination of fear and joy, Jesus asked them, "Do you have anything to eat?" They gave Jesus a piece of boiled fish, and he took it and ate it in front of them. And the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them, "Peace be unto you. Just as the Father has sent me, even so I send you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. Whosoever sin you forgive, they are forgiven, and whosoever sin you retain, they are retained." But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. When the other disciples told Thomas that they had seen the Lord, he did not believe it, but said, "Unless I see the nail prints on his hands, and put my hand into the wound in his side, I will not believe."
Paper 191, Appearances to the Apostles and Other Leaders. Resurrection Sunday was a terrible day in the lives of the apostles. 10 of them spent the larger part of the day in the upper chamber behind barred doors. They might have fled from Jerusalem, but they were afraid of being arrested by the agents of the Sanhedrin if they were found abroad. Thomas was brooding over his troubles alone at Bethpage. He would have fared better had he remained with his fellow apostles, and he would have aided them to direct their discussions along more helpful lines. All day long, John upheld the idea that Jesus had risen from the dead. He recounted no less than 5 different times when the Master had affirmed he would rise again, and at least 3 times when he alluded to the third day. John's attitude had considerable influence on them, especially on his brother James and on Nathanael. John would have influenced them more if he had not been the youngest member of the group. Their isolation had much to do with their troubles. John Mark kept them in touch with developments about the temple and informed them as to the many rumors gaining headway in the city, but it did not occur to him to gather up news from the different groups of believers to whom Jesus had already appeared. That was the kind of service which had heretofore been rendered by the messengers of David, but they were all absent on their last assignment as heralds of the resurrection to those groups of believers who dwelt remote from Jerusalem. For the first time in all these years, the apostles realized how much they had been dependent on David's messengers for their daily information regarding the affairs of the kingdom. All this day, Peter characteristically vacillated emotionally between faith and doubt concerning the Master's resurrection. Peter could not get away from the sight of the grave cloths resting there in the tomb as if the body of Jesus had just evaporated from within. But, reasoned Peter, if he has risen and can show himself to the women, why does he not show himself to us, his apostles? Peter would grow sorrowful when he thought that maybe Jesus did not come to them on account of his presence among the apostles, because he had denied him that night in Annas' courtyard. And then would he cheer himself with the word brought by the women, "Go tell my apostles and Peter." But to derive encouragement from this message implied that he must believe that the women had really seen and heard the risen Master. Thus Peter alternated between faith and doubt throughout the whole day, until a little after 8 o'clock, when he ventured out into the courtyard. Peter thought to remove himself from among the apostles, so that he might not prevent Jesus' coming to them because of his denial of the Master. James Zebedee at first advocated that they all go to the tomb. He was strongly in favor of doing something to get to the bottom of the mystery. It was Nathanael who prevented them from going out in public in response to James's urging, and he did this by reminding them of Jesus' warning against unduly jeopardizing their lives at this time. By noontime, James had settled down with the others to watchful waiting. He said little. He was tremendously disappointed because Jesus did not appear to them, and he did not know of the Master's many appearances to other groups and individuals. Andrew did much listening this day. He was exceedingly perplexed by the situation and had more than his share of doubts, but he at least enjoyed a certain sense of freedom from responsibility for the guidance of his fellow apostles. He was indeed grateful that the Master had released him from the burdens of leadership before they fell upon these distracting times. More than once during the long and weary hours of this tragic day, the only sustaining influence of the group was the frequent contribution of Nathanael's characteristic philosophic counsel. He was really the controlling influence among the 10 throughout the entire day. Never once did he express himself concerning either belief or disbelief in the Master's resurrection, but as the day wore on, he became increasingly inclined toward believing that Jesus had fulfilled his promise to rise again. Simon Zelotes was too much crushed to participate in the discussions. Most of the time he reclined on a couch in a corner of the room with his face to the wall. He did not speak 6 times throughout the whole day. His concept of the kingdom had crashed, and he could not discern that the Master's resurrection could materially change the situation. His disappointment was very personal, and altogether too keen to be recovered from on short notice, even in the face of such a stupendous fact as the resurrection. Strange to record, the usually inexpressive Philip did much talking throughout the afternoon of this day. During the forenoon he had little to say, but all afternoon he asked questions of the other apostles. Peter was often annoyed by Philip's questions, but the others took his inquiries good-naturedly. Philip was particularly desirous of knowing, provided Jesus had really risen from the grave, whether his body would bear the physical marks of the crucifixion. Matthew was highly confused. He listened to the discussions of his fellows, but spent most of the time turning over in his mind the problem of their future finances. Regardless of Jesus' supposed resurrection, Judas was gone. David had unceremoniously turned the funds over to him, and they were without an authoritative leader. Before Matthew got around to giving serious consideration to their arguments about the resurrection, he had already seen the Master face to face. The Alpheus twins took little part in these serious discussions. They were fairly busy with their customary ministrations. One of them expressed the attitude of both when he said, in reply to a question asked by Philip, "We do not understand about the resurrection, but our mother says she talked with the Master, and we believe her." Thomas was in the midst of one of his typical spells of despairing depression. He slept a portion of the day and walked over the hills the rest of the time. He felt the urge to rejoin his fellow apostles, but the desire to be by himself was the stronger. The Master put off the first Maroncha appearance to the apostles for a number of reasons. First, he wanted them to have time, after they heard of his resurrection, to think well over what he had told them about his death and resurrection when he was still with them in the flesh. The Master wanted Peter to wrestle through with some of his peculiar difficulties before he manifested himself to them all. In the second place, he desired that Thomas should be with them at the time of his first appearance. John Mark located Thomas at the home of Simon in Bethpage early this Sunday morning, bringing word to that effect to the apostles about 11 o'clock. Any time during this day Thomas would have gone back to them if Nathanael or any two of the other apostles had gone for him. He really wanted to return, but having left as he did the evening before, he was too proud to go back of his own accord so soon. By the next day he was so depressed that it required almost a week for him to make up his mind to return. The apostles waited for him, and he waited for his brethren to seek him out and ask him to come back to them. Thomas thus remained away from his associates until the next Saturday evening, when, after darkness had come on, Peter and John went over to Bethpage and brought him back with them. And this is also the reason why they did not go at once to Galilee after Jesus first appeared to them. They would not go without Thomas. 1. The Appearance to Peter. It was near 8:30 this Sunday evening when Jesus appeared to Simon Peter in the garden of the Mark home. This was his 8th Maroncha manifestation. Peter had lived under a heavy burden of doubt and guilt ever since his denial of the Master. All day Saturday and this Sunday he had fought the fear that, perhaps, he was no longer an apostle. He had shuddered at the fate of Judas, and even thought that he, too, had betrayed his Master. All this afternoon he thought that it might be his presence with the apostles that prevented Jesus' appearing to them, provided, of course, he had really risen from the dead. And it was to Peter, in such a frame of mind and in such a state of soul, that Jesus appeared as the dejected apostle strolled among the flowers and shrubs. When Peter thought of the loving look of the Master as he passed by on Annas's porch, and as he turned over in his mind that wonderful message brought him early that morning by the women who came from the empty tomb, "Go tell my apostles," and Peter, as he contemplated these tokens of mercy, his faith began to surmount his doubts, and he stood still, clenching his fists, while he spoke aloud, "I believe he has risen from the dead. I will go and tell my brethren." And as he said this, there suddenly appeared in front of him the form of a man, who spoke to him in familiar tones, saying, "Peter, the enemy desired to have you, but I would not give you up. I knew it was not from the heart that you disowned me. Therefore I forgave you even before you asked. But now must you cease to think about yourself and the troubles of the hour, while you prepare to carry the good news of the gospel to those who sit in darkness. No longer should you be concerned with what you may obtain from the kingdom, but rather be exercised about what you can give to those who live in dire spiritual poverty. Gird yourself, Simon, for the battle of a new day, the struggle with spiritual darkness and the evil doubtings of the natural minds of men. Peter and the Maroncha Jesus walked through the garden and talked of things past, present, and future for almost 5 minutes. Then the Master vanished from his gaze, saying, "Farewell, Peter, until I see you with your brethren." For a moment, Peter was overcome by the realization that he had talked with the risen Master, and that he could be sure he was still an ambassador of the kingdom. He had just heard the glorified Master exhort him to go on preaching the gospel. And with all this welling up within his heart, he rushed to the upper chamber and into the presence of his fellow apostles, exclaiming in breathless excitement, "I have seen the Master. He was in the garden. I talked with him, and he has forgiven me." Peter's declaration that he had seen Jesus in the garden made a profound impression upon his fellow apostles, and they were about ready to surrender their doubts when Andrew got up and warned them not to be too much influenced by his brother's report. Andrew intimated that Peter had seen things which were not real before. Although Andrew did not directly allude to the vision of the night on the Sea of Galilee, wherein Peter claimed to have seen the Master coming to them walking on the water, he said enough to betray to all present that he had this incident in mind. Simon Peter was very much hurt by his brother's insinuations and immediately lapsed into crestfallen silence. The twins felt very sorry for Peter, and they both went over to express their sympathy and to say that they believed him and to reassert that their own mother had also seen the Master. 2. First Appearance to the Apostles. Shortly after 9 o'clock that evening, after the departure of Cleopas and Jacob, while the Alpheus twins comforted Peter, and while Nathanael remonstrated with Andrew, and as the 10 apostles were there assembled in the upper chamber, with all the doors bolted for fear of arrest, the Master, in Maroncha form, suddenly appeared in the midst of them, saying, "Peace be upon you. Why are you so frightened when I appear, as though you had seen a spirit? Did I not tell you about these things when I was present with you in the flesh? Did I not say to you that the chief priests and the rulers would deliver me up to be killed, that one of your own number would betray me, and that on the third day I would rise? Wherefore all your doubtings and all this discussion about the reports of the women, Cleopas and Jacob, and even Peter? How long will you doubt my words and refuse to believe my promises? And now that you actually see me, will you believe? Even now one of you is absent. When you are gathered together once more, and after all of you know of a certainty that the Son of Man has risen from the grave, go hence into Galilee. Have faith in God. Have faith in one another. And so shall you enter into the new service of the kingdom of heaven. I will tarry in Jerusalem with you until you are ready to go into Galilee. My peace I leave with you." When the Maroncha Jesus had spoken to them, he vanished in an instant from their sight, and they all fell on their faces, praising God and venerating their vanished Master. This was the Master's 9th Maroncha appearance.
Chapter 150, 6th Appearance of Jesus. After 8 days, the disciples were together again in a room that had been bolted from the inside for fear of the Jews. This time Thomas was with them. Jesus appeared to them and stood in the middle of them and said, "Peace be unto you." Then he said to Thomas, "Look at my hands and touch my wounds. Take your hand and put it into my side. Don't be faithless, but believing." Thomas answered and said to Jesus, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen, you believe. Blessed are those that have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus did many other signs in their presence, which are not written in this book. But these things are written, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name.
4. The 10th Appearance at Philadelphia. The 10th Maroncha manifestation of Jesus to mortal recognition occurred a short time after 8 o'clock on Tuesday, April 11, at Philadelphia, where he showed himself to Abner and Lazarus and some 150 of their associates, including more than 50 of the evangelistic corps of the 70. This appearance occurred just after the opening of a special meeting in the synagogue, which had been called by Abner to discuss the crucifixion of Jesus and the more recent report of the resurrection, which had been brought by David's messenger. Inasmuch as the resurrected Lazarus was now a member of this group of believers, it was not difficult for them to believe the report that Jesus had risen from the dead. The meeting in the synagogue was just being opened by Abner and Lazarus, who were standing together in the pulpit, when the entire audience of believers saw the form of the Master appear suddenly. He stepped forward from where he had appeared between Abner and Lazarus, neither of whom had observed him, and saluting the company, said, "Peace be upon you. You all know that we have one Father in heaven, and that there is but one gospel of the kingdom, the good news of the gift of eternal life which men receive by faith. As you rejoice in your loyalty to the gospel, pray the Father of truth to shed abroad in your hearts a new and greater love for your brethren. You are to love all men as I have loved you. You are to serve all men as I have served you. With understanding, sympathy, and brotherly affection, fellowship all your brethren who are dedicated to the proclamation of the good news, whether they be Jew or Gentile, Greek or Roman, Persian or Ethiopian. John proclaimed the kingdom in advance. You have preached the gospel in power. The Greeks already teach the good news, and I am soon to send forth the Spirit of truth into the souls of all these, my brethren, who have so unselfishly dedicated their lives to the enlightenment of their fellows who sit in spiritual darkness. You are all the children of light. Therefore stumble not into the misunderstanding entanglements of mortal suspicion and human intolerance. If you are ennobled by the grace of faith to love unbelievers, should you not also equally love those who are your fellow believers in the far-spreading household of faith? Remember, as you love one another, all men will know that you are my disciples. Go then into all the world proclaiming this gospel of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men to all nations and races, and ever be wise in your choice of methods for presenting the good news to the different races and tribes of mankind. Freely you have received this gospel of the kingdom, and you will freely give the good news to all nations. Fear not the resistance of evil, for I am with you always, even to the end of the ages, and my peace I leave with you." When he had said, "My peace I leave with you," he vanished from their sight. With the exception of one of his appearances in Galilee, where upward of 500 believers saw him at one time, this group in Philadelphia embraced the largest number of mortals who saw him on any single occasion. Early the next morning, even while the apostles tarried in Jerusalem awaiting the emotional recovery of Thomas, these believers at Philadelphia went forth proclaiming that Jesus of Nazareth had risen from the dead. The next day, Wednesday, Jesus spent without interruption in the society of his Maroncha associates, and during the mid-afternoon hours, he received visiting Maroncha delegates from the mansion worlds of every local system of inhabited spheres throughout the constellation of Norlaciadec, and they all rejoiced to know their Creator as one of their own order of universe intelligence. Five, Second Appearance to the Apostles. Thomas spent a lonesome week alone with himself in the hills around about Olivet. During this time he saw only those at Simon's house and John Mark. It was about 9 o'clock on Saturday, April 15, when the two apostles found him and took him back with them to their rendezvous at the Mark home. The next day, Thomas listened to the telling of the stories of the Master's various appearances, but he steadfastly refused to believe. He maintained that Peter had enthused them into thinking they had seen the Master. Nathanael reasoned with him, but it did no good. There was an emotional stubbornness associated with his customary doubtfulness, and this state of mind, coupled with his chagrin at having run away from them, conspired to create a situation of isolation which even Thomas himself did not fully understand. He had withdrawn from his fellows, he had gone his own way, and now, even when he was back among them, he unconsciously tended to assume an attitude of disagreement. He was slow to surrender. He disliked to give in. Without intending it, he really enjoyed the attention paid him. He derived unconscious satisfaction from the efforts of all his fellows to convince and convert him. He had missed them for a full week, and he obtained considerable pleasure from their persistent attentions. They were having their evening meal a little after 6 o'clock, with Peter sitting on one side of Thomas and Nathanael on the other, when the doubting apostle said, "I will not believe unless I see the Master with my own eyes and put my finger in the mark of the nails." As they thus sat at supper, and while the doors were securely shut and barred, the Maroncha master suddenly appeared inside the curvature of the table and, standing directly in front of Thomas, said, "Peace be upon you. For a full week have I tarried that I might appear again when you were all present to hear once more the commission to go into all the world and preach this gospel of the kingdom. Again I tell you, as the Father sent me into the world, so send I you. As I have revealed the Father, so shall you reveal the divine love, not merely with words, but in your daily living. I send you forth not to love the souls of men, but rather to love men. You are not merely to proclaim the joys of heaven, but also to exhibit in your daily experience these spirit realities of the divine life, since you already have eternal life, as the gift of God through faith. When you have faith, when power from on high, the Spirit of truth, has come upon you, you will not hide your light here behind closed doors. You will make known the love and the mercy of God to all mankind. Through fear you now flee from the facts of a disagreeable experience. But when you shall have been baptized with the Spirit of truth, you will bravely and joyously go forth to meet the new experiences of proclaiming the good news of eternal life in the kingdom of God. You may tarry here and in Galilee for a short season while you recover from the shock of the transition from the false security of the authority of traditionalism to the new order of the authority of the facts, truth, and faith in the supreme realities of living experience. Your mission to the world is founded on the fact that I lived a God-revealing life among you, on the truth that you and all other men are the sons of God, and it shall consist in the life which you will live among men, the actual and living experience of loving men and serving them, even as I have loved and served you. Let faith reveal your light to the world. Let the revelation of truth open the eyes blinded by tradition. Let your loving service effectually destroy the prejudice engendered by ignorance. By so drawing close to your fellow men in understanding sympathy and with unselfish devotion, you will lead them into a saving knowledge of the Father's love. The Jews have extolled goodness. The Greeks have exalted beauty. The Hindus preach devotion. The faraway ascetics teach reverence. The Romans demand loyalty. But I require of my disciples life, even a life of loving service for your brothers in the flesh." When the Master had so spoken, he looked down into the face of Thomas and said, "And you, Thomas, who said you would not believe unless you could see me and put your finger in the nail marks of my hands, have now beheld me and heard my words, and though you see no nail marks on my hands, since I am raised in the form that you also shall have when you depart from this world, what will you say to your brethren? You will acknowledge the truth, for already in your heart you had begun to believe even when you so stoutly asserted your unbelief. Your doubts, Thomas, always most stubbornly assert themselves just as they are about to crumble. Thomas, I bid you be not faithless, but believing, and I know you will believe even with a whole heart." When Thomas heard these words, he fell on his knees before the Maroncha master and exclaimed, "I believe, my Lord and my Master." Then said Jesus to Thomas, "You have believed, Thomas, because you have really seen and heard me. Blessed are those in the ages to come who will believe even though they have not seen with the eye of flesh, nor heard with the mortal ear." And then as the Master's form moved over near the head of the table, he addressed them all, saying, "And now go all of you to Galilee, where I will presently appear to you." After he said this, he vanished from their sight. The 11 apostles were now fully convinced that Jesus had risen from the dead, and very early the next morning, before the break of day, they started out for Galilee. 6. The Alexandrian Appearance. While the 11 apostles were on the way to Galilee, drawing near their journey's end, on Tuesday evening, April 18, at about 8:30, Jesus appeared to Rodan and some 80 other believers in Alexandria. This was the Master's 12th appearance in Maroncha form. Jesus appeared before these Greeks and Jews at the conclusion of the report of David's messenger regarding the crucifixion. This messenger, being the fifth in the Jerusalem-Alexandria relay of runners, had arrived in Alexandria late that afternoon, and when he had delivered his message to Rodan, it was decided to call the believers together to receive this tragic word from the messenger himself. At about 8:00, the messenger, Nathan of Busiris, came before this group and told them in detail all that had been told him by the preceding runner. Nathan ended his touching recital with these words, "But David, who sends us this word, reports that the Master, in foretelling his death, declared that he would rise again." Even as Nathan spoke, the Maroncha Master appeared there in full view of all. And when Nathan sat down, Jesus said, "Peace be upon you. That which my Father sent me into the world to establish belongs not to a race, a nation, nor to a special group of teachers or preachers. This gospel of the kingdom belongs to both Jew and Gentile, to rich and poor, to free and bond, to male and female, even to the little children. And you are all to proclaim this gospel of love and truth by the lives which you live in the flesh. You shall love one another with a new and startling affection, even as I have loved you. You will serve mankind with a new and amazing devotion, even as I have served you. And when men see you so love them, and when they behold how fervently you serve them, they will perceive that you have become faith fellows of the kingdom of heaven, and they will follow after the spirit of truth which they see in your lives, to the finding of eternal salvation. As the Father sent me into this world, even so now send I you. You are all called to carry the good news to those who sit in darkness. This gospel of the kingdom belongs to all who believe it. It shall not be committed to the custody of mere priests. Soon will the Spirit of truth come upon you, and he shall lead you into all truth. Go you, therefore, into all the world preaching this gospel, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the ages." When the Master had so spoken, he vanished from their sight. All that night these believers remained there together, recounting their experiences as kingdom believers, and listening to the many words of Rodan and his associates. And they all believed that Jesus had risen from the dead. Imagine the surprise of David's herald of the resurrection, who arrived the second day after this, when they replied to his announcement saying, "Yes, we know, for we have seen him. He appeared to us day before yesterday."
Chapter 151, Seventh Appearance of Jesus. After this, Jesus appeared to them again at the Sea of Tiberias. Peter had decided to go fishing, and the other disciples followed along. They went into a boat and fished all night, but caught nothing. When the morning came, they saw Jesus standing on the beach. The disciples did not immediately recognize that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have anything to eat?" They answered, "No." And Jesus said to them, "Cast your net on the right side of the boat, and you will." They did as Jesus said, and the nets were so full that they could not lift them into the boat. John said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Peter knew it was Jesus, he wrapped his coat around him and jumped into the sea and swam for shore. The other disciples stayed in the boats and made their way to shore, dragging the net full of fish. When they got to land, they saw that Jesus had started a fire and that coals were burning, and fish was cooking, and there was bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have caught." Peter went up and pulled the nets full of fish on shore. They had caught 153 large fish, but the nets had not broken. "Come and have breakfast," said Jesus. Jesus gave them bread and fish. This was the third time that Jesus had appeared to the disciples after he had risen from the dead. After eating breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me better than fishing?" Peter answered, "You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." Again, the second time, Jesus asked Peter, "Peter, do you love me more than this fishing business?" Peter answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Then Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." Then Jesus said to Peter the third time, "Peter, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter replied, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I tell you, when you were young, you walked where you wanted to walk. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will carry you where you do not want to go." Jesus was telling Peter ahead of time how his death would glorify God. And when he had said this, he said to them, "Follow me." And as they followed Jesus, Peter, turning around and seeing John, asked Jesus, "What will happen to John?" Jesus said to Peter, "If it's my will that John live until I come, what business is that of yours?" Even though Jesus did not say that John would not die, the rumor got started among the disciples. There are many other things that Jesus did, which if they should all be written, would fill the world with books.
Paper 192, Appearances in Galilee. By the time the apostles left Jerusalem for Galilee, the Jewish leaders had quieted down considerably. Since Jesus appeared only to his family of kingdom believers, and since the apostles were in hiding and did no public preaching, the rulers of the Jews concluded that the gospel movement was, after all, effectually crushed. They were, of course, disconcerted by the increasing spread of rumors that Jesus had risen from the dead, but they depended upon the bribed guards effectively to counteract all such reports by their reiteration of the story that a band of his followers had removed the body. From this time on until the apostles were dispersed by the rising tide of persecution, Peter was the generally recognized head of the apostolic corps. Jesus never gave him any such authority, and his fellow apostles never formally elected him to such a position of responsibility. He naturally assumed it and held it by common consent, and also because he was their chief preacher. From now on, public preaching became the main business of the apostles. After their return from Galilee, Matthias, whom they chose to take the place of Judas, became their treasurer. During the week they tarried in Jerusalem, Mary, the mother of Jesus, spent much of the time with the women believers who were stopping at the home of Joseph of Arimathea. Early this Monday morning, when the apostles departed for Galilee, John Mark went along. He followed them out of the city, and when they had passed well beyond Bethany, he boldly came up among them, feeling confident they would not send him back. The apostles paused several times on the way to Galilee to tell the story of their risen master, and therefore did not arrive at Bethsaida until very late on Wednesday night. It was noontime on Thursday before they were all awake and ready to partake of breakfast. 1. Appearance by the Lake. About 6 o'clock Friday morning, April 21, the Maroncha Master made his 13th appearance, the first in Galilee, to the 10 apostles as their boat drew near the shore, close to the usual landing place at Bethsaida. After the apostles had spent the afternoon and early evening of Thursday in waiting at the Zebedee home, Simon Peter suggested that they go fishing. When Peter proposed the fishing trip, all of the apostles decided to go along. All night they toiled with the nets but caught no fish. They did not much mind the failure to make a catch, for they had many interesting experiences to talk over, things which had so recently happened to them at Jerusalem. But when daylight came, they decided to return to Bethsaida. As they neared the shore, they saw someone on the beach, near the boat landing, standing by a fire. At first they thought it was John Mark, who had come down to welcome them back with their catch. But as they drew nearer the shore, they saw they were mistaken. The man was too tall for John. It had occurred to none of them that the person on the shore was the master. They did not altogether understand why Jesus wanted to meet them amidst the scenes of their earlier associations and out in the open in contact with nature, far away from the shut-in environment of Jerusalem, with its tragic associations of fear, betrayal, and death. He had told them that, if they would go into Galilee, he would meet them there, and he was about to fulfill that promise. As they dropped anchor and prepared to enter the small boat for going ashore, the man on the beach called to them, "Lads, have you caught anything?" And when they answered no, he spoke again, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find fish." While they did not know it was Jesus who had directed them, with one accord they cast the net as they had been instructed, and immediately it was filled, so much so that they were hardly able to draw it up. Now John Zebedee was quick of perception, and when he saw the heavy-laden net, he perceived that it was the Master who had spoken to them. When this thought came into his mind, he leaned over and whispered to Peter, "It is the Master." Peter was ever a man of thoughtless action and impetuous devotion, so when John whispered this in his ear, he quickly arose and cast himself into the water, that he might the sooner reach the Master's side. His brethren came up close behind him, having come ashore in the small boat, hauling the net of fishes after them. By this time John Mark was up, and, seeing the apostles coming ashore with the heavy-laden net, ran down the beach to greet them. And when he saw 11 men instead of 10, he surmised that the unrecognized one was the risen Jesus. And as the astonished 10 stood by in silence, the youth rushed up to the Master and, kneeling at his feet, said, "My Lord and my Master." And then Jesus spoke, not as he had in Jerusalem, when he greeted them with, "Peace be upon you," but in commonplace tones he addressed John Mark. "Well, John, I am glad to see you again and in carefree Galilee, where we can have a good visit. Stay with us, John, and have breakfast." As Jesus talked with the young man, the 10 were so astonished and surprised that they neglected to haul the net of fish in upon the beach. Now spoke Jesus, "Bring in your fish and prepare some for breakfast. Already we have the fire and much bread." While John Mark had paid homage to the Master, Peter had for a moment been shocked at the sight of the coals of fire glowing there on the beach. The scene reminded him so vividly of the midnight fire of charcoal in the courtyard of Annas, where he had disowned the Master, but he shook himself and, kneeling at the Master's feet, exclaimed, "My Lord and my Master." Peter then joined his comrades as they hauled in the net. When they had landed their catch, they counted the fish, and there were 153 large ones. And again was the mistake made of calling this another miraculous catch of fish. There was no miracle connected with this episode. It was merely an exercise of the Master's pre-knowledge. He knew the fish were there, and accordingly directed the apostles where to cast the net. Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Come now, all of you, to breakfast. Even the twins should sit down while I visit with you. John Mark will dress the fish." John Mark brought 7 good-sized fish, which the Master put on the fire, and when they were cooked, the lads served them to the 10. Then Jesus broke the bread and handed it to John, who in turn served it to the hungry apostles. When they had all been served, Jesus bade John Mark sit down, while he himself served the fish and the bread to the lad. And as they ate, Jesus visited with them and recounted their many experiences in Galilee and by this very lake. This was the third time Jesus had manifested himself to the apostles as a group. When Jesus first addressed them, asking if they had any fish, they did not suspect who he was because it was a common experience for these fishermen on the Sea of Galilee, when they came ashore, to be thus accosted by the fish merchants of Tarichaea, who were usually on hand to buy the fresh catches for the drying establishments. Jesus visited with the 10 apostles and John Mark for more than an hour, and then he walked up and down the beach, talking with them two and two, but not the same couples he had first sent out together to teach. All 11 of the apostles had come down from Jerusalem together, but Simon Zelotes grew more and more despondent as they drew near Galilee, so that, when they reached Bethsaida, he forsook his brethren and returned to his home. Before taking leave of them this morning, Jesus directed that 2 of the apostles should volunteer to go to Simon Zelotes and bring him back that very day. And Peter and Andrew did so.
Chapter 152, Eighth Appearance of Jesus. The 11 disciples went into Galilee, up on the mountain where the Lord had said he would meet them, and they were joined by 500 other friends and relatives of Jesus. Jesus appeared to them all, and they worshipped him, but a few doubted. Chapter 153, The Great Commission. And Jesus came to them and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." And he said to them, "Go into the world and preach the gospel to the whole creation, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all the things that I have commanded you. He that believeth and is baptized will be saved, but he that disbelieveth shall be condemned. This has been written that the Christ should suffer and rise again from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name to all the nations, starting in Jerusalem. And these signs will accompany those that believe. In my name they will cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will take up serpents and drink deadly things, and it will not hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. I am with you always, even unto the end of the world."
3. On the Mount of Ordination. At noon on Saturday, April 22, the 11 apostles assembled by appointment on the hill near Capernaum, and Jesus appeared among them. This meeting occurred on the very mount where the Master had set them apart as his apostles and as ambassadors of the Father's kingdom on earth. And this was the Master's 14th Maranatha manifestation. At this time the 11 apostles knelt in a circle about the Master and heard him repeat the charges and saw him reenact the ordination scene, even as when they were first set apart for the special work of the kingdom. And all of this was to them as a memory of their former consecration to the Father's service, except the Master's prayer. When the Master, the Maranatha Jesus, now prayed, it was in tones of majesty and with words of power such as the apostles had never before heard. Their Master now spoke with the rulers of the universes as one who, in his own universe, had had all power and authority committed to his hand. And these 11 men never forgot this experience of the Maranatha rededication to the former pledges of ambassadorship. The Master spent just 1 hour on this mount with his ambassadors, and when he had taken an affectionate farewell of them, he vanished from their sight. And no one saw Jesus for a full week. The apostles really had no idea what to do, not knowing whether the Master had gone to the Father. In this state of uncertainty, they tarried at Bethsaida. They were afraid to go fishing, lest he come to visit them, and they miss seeing him. During this entire week, Jesus was occupied with the Maranatha creatures on earth, and with the affairs of the Maranatha transition, which he was experiencing on this world. 4. The Lakeside Gathering. Word of the appearances of Jesus was spreading throughout Galilee, and every day increasing numbers of believers arrived at the Zebedee home to inquire about the Master's resurrection and to find out the truth about these reputed appearances. Peter, early in the week, sent out word that a public meeting would be held by the seaside the next Sabbath at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Accordingly, on Saturday, April 29, at 3 o'clock, more than 500 believers from the environs of Capernaum assembled at Bethsaida to hear Peter preach his first public sermon since the resurrection. The apostle was at his best, and after he had finished his appealing discourse, few of his hearers doubted that the Master had risen from the dead. Peter ended his sermon saying, "We affirm that Jesus of Nazareth is not dead. We declare that he has risen from the tomb. We proclaim that we have seen him and talked with him." Just as he finished making this declaration of faith, there by his side in full view of all these people, the Master appeared in Maranatha form and, speaking to them in familiar accents, said, "Peace be upon you, and my peace I leave with you." When he had thus appeared, and had so spoken to them, he vanished from their sight. This was the 15th Maranatha manifestation of the risen Jesus. Because of certain things said to the 11 while they were in conference with the Master on the Mount of Ordination, the apostles received the impression that their Master would presently make a public appearance before a group of the Galilean believers, and that, after he had done so, they were to return to Jerusalem. Accordingly, early the next day, Sunday, April 30, the 11 left Bethsaida for Jerusalem. They did considerable teaching and preaching on the way down the Jordan, so that they did not arrive at the home of the Marks in Jerusalem until late on Wednesday, May 3. This was a sad homecoming for John Mark. Just a few hours before he reached home, his father, Elijah Mark, suddenly died from a hemorrhage in the brain. Although the thought of the certainty of the resurrection of the dead did much to comfort the apostles in their grief, at the same time they truly mourned the loss of their good friend, who had been their staunch supporter even in the times of great trouble and disappointment. John Mark did all he could to comfort his mother and, speaking for her, invited the apostles to continue to make their home at her house. And the 11 made this upper chamber their headquarters until after the day of Pentecost. The apostles had purposely entered Jerusalem after nightfall that they might not be seen by the Jewish authorities. Neither did they publicly appear in connection with the funeral of Elijah Mark. All the next day they remained in quiet seclusion in this eventful upper chamber. On Thursday night, the apostles had a wonderful meeting in this upper chamber, and all pledged themselves to go forth in the public preaching of the new gospel of the risen Lord, except Thomas, Simon Zelotes, and the Alphaeus twins. Already had begun the first steps of changing the gospel of the kingdom, sonship with God and brotherhood with man, into the proclamation of the resurrection of Jesus. Nathanael opposed this shift in the burden of their public message, but he could not withstand Peter's eloquence, neither could he overcome the enthusiasm of the disciples, especially the women believers. And so, under the vigorous leadership of Peter, and ere the Master ascended to the Father, his well-meaning representatives began that subtle process of gradually and certainly changing the religion of Jesus into a new and modified form of religion about Jesus.
And there you have it. The resurrection and the appearances of Jesus, both in Jerusalem and in Galilee. And we're not done yet. Join us next week for the ascension of Jesus. We'll see you then. We'd like to thank the Urantia Book Fellowship and the Bible Heritage Foundation for the story of Jesus and permission to use this material. And we'd like to thank the Cosmic Citizen. And we'd like to thank you. Please join us next week for the ascension and more appearances of Jesus in Jerusalem and the coming of the Paraclete, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, Pentecost. See you then.